Hi, you're listening to iiPod, the official podcast of the Duke Lemur Center in Durham, North Carolina.
I'm Matt Bortz, curator of fossils at the Duke Lemur Center.
And I'm Megan McGrath, education programs manager at the Duke Lemur Center. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Megan. Today, we're talking with a researcher based in New York City who's done a great deal of work on rough lemurs, or Varicia, in Madagascar. She focuses particularly on their social dynamics and their genetics.
So my name is Dr. Andrea Baden. I have multiple titles. So I am an associate professor of anthropology at Hunter College. I'm director of the Primate Molecular Ecology Lab, also at Hunter. And I also am founder and director of the Rana Mafana Rough Lemur Project in Madagascar. I'm sort of a jack of all trades, I suppose.
You wear a lot of hats. Let's first focus on your research, especially in Rana Mafana. So Rana Mafana National Park in southeastern Madagascar. What are the big questions that you're trying to answer there?
I would say my two big picture questions really are trying to understand how features in the landscape influence genetic diversity, genetic health, and gene flow within natural landscapes. So that's one. But then also using that information to inform our understanding of the evolution of complex traits within populations. And so my two big questions in that regard are related to fission-fusion social dynamics. So how underlying genetic diversity can predict variation in social relationships among individuals. And then also more specifically, how that relates to infant care strategies. So does genetic relatedness influence patterns of infant care? And if genetic relatedness doesn't influence patterns of infant care, what does?
With all of these questions that are floating around, how are you actually practically studying these things and collecting the data that you need?
So my research takes a couple of different approaches. One is that I do field work. So I have a long-term study in Madagascar. I established it back in 2005. And so essentially what that looks like is I've got a team of about 10 Malagasy field technicians and Malagasy students and trainees that basically live out in the forest. So it's a 2-week on, 1-week off expedition cycle because it's a really remote rainforest site. Our animals are radio collared, so we can individually identify them. And essentially, we'll go out, we'll find the animals in the forest, and every day we'll follow them from dawn until dusk. We'll collect behavioral observations, we'll collect GPS ranging coordinates, we'll collect fecal samples, food samples of the items they've been consuming, and preserve all of that stuff. And then we bring that back to the lab, and that's where the lab work comes in. And so I have students who have been analyzing the fecal samples for genetics, for hormones, for energy balance. We've been analyzing the plant samples for the nutritional quality of the food items that the animals are consuming. And then we also, once a year, do captures where we will actually anesthetize the animals, bring them back to camp, replace radio collars that help us to find them. But then we also collect high quality biological samples like blood and tissue that we can use for other molecular analyses down the road.
So when you're anesthetizing animals in the field, can you walk us through that process a bit? Like who's involved and what your procedures are for getting helpful information, but also making sure the animals get back to the wild safe and healthy?
Yeah, and it's a really involved process. And this is something I'm really lucky. I've been doing it for a long time, but I've also been working with a really experienced team. I collaborate really closely with Randy Youngy from the Columbus Zoo. And so every August, he comes out with me into the forest along with Velu, who's a darter who's got over 25 years now of capture experience. So he'll essentially use a CO2-powered rifle to shoot these darts that are loaded with an anesthetic that puts the lemurs temporarily to sleep. And then we have a team of people out in the forest with giant nets that look kind of like volleyball nets. And they'll position themselves under the lemurs so that when the lemur falls asleep, the lemur falls from the tree, lands in the net, and we can safely bring them back to camp. And at that point, Randy and Malagasy vets will monitor the vitals of the animal. They'll do full workups of the animal to make sure that the animal hasn't been injured. We'll take biomedical health assessments, so essentially monitoring patterns of health and disease in the population to make sure that everybody's healthy. And then after we've done all of our measurements, we'll collect body mass and our basic biological samples. We'll give them some essentially like IV fluids to help them wake up. And then we keep them safe actually in a pillowcase, which helps to reduce stress to the animals. So it keeps, it cuts the noise down and it reduces visual stimulation so that they can wake up in a safe environment where they won't hurt themselves if they get scared. And once they're awake, we take them back out into the forest to exactly where we found them. And then we'll release them from the pillowcase so that they can rejoin their group. And we've been doing this since 2005. And we're really lucky. We have such a great team. We've never lost an animal due to these procedures. And animals have always been healthy and safe. I think if anything were to happen, I probably would never do it again.
So how did you wind up in the forest tracking rough lemurs and also with a lab studying all of these data? What's your journey into lemur science?
My journey to where I am today is really circuitous. And I love to tell this to students because I think that it's important to keep in mind that you don't necessarily have to know what you want to be when you grow up. And so as a kid, just outside the Everglades, I knew I liked animals. I liked nature. My thing was just to go out into the woods and explore. But I always thought I wanted to be an artist or a writer or like a journalist or something. And so I actually went to college to be an elementary school teacher. Did that for a while and wasn't quite right up my alley. So I actually then changed majors to art photography, really liked it, but realized I wasn't exceptional at it. So then I switched to photojournalism. And as a photojournalism major, I actually really was inspired to go on a study abroad trip. And I had a teacher who pointed me in the direction of this Madagascar study abroad trip. And so my plan had been to go to Madagascar, do a photojournalism project on the lives of people in Madagascar. But when I got there, I realized, holy cow, you can get paid to go out into the rainforest and study animals. And I was way more inspired by the process of studying the animals than just photo documenting them. And so as soon as I got home, I immediately changed my major. It was my second semester junior year, so I had a lot of catching up to do. But that really like set the trajectory for the rest of my life. And so I tell students all the time, like, you won't know what you like until you try it. And you don't even know stuff exists until you get exposed to it. So just try everything.
Andrea began to study anthropology at the University of Miami and found a mentor in lemur researcher, Dr. Linda Taylor.
And she's actually sort of notorious for this. She finds students, takes them under her wing, and then turns them to the dark side, and we all become anthropologists.
Andrea went on to graduate school at Stony Brook University, working with Dr. Pat Wright. Dr. Wright is a friend of the Lemur Center and has been doing fieldwork in Madagascar for decades. When Andrea got started at Stony Brook, Dr. Wright was doing research on the relationship between weather patterns and habitats in Madagascar.
And so actually, the whole question about like why rough lemurs was because of a grad project I did, one of my core classes. We just had to come up with some different questions. And I realized that rough lemurs, they have this really unusual form of social organization where they do this fission fusion sort of thing that chimpanzees and humans do, which I thought was fascinating, that you have these lemurs that supposedly everyone talks about as being really primitive. I mean, we know they're not, right? But for a long time, people argued that lemurs were super behaviorally primitive. And so I was really curious in understanding how you come to be so socially complex in the same ways, it seems, that chimpanzees and humans do. And so that's what initially inspired it. And, you know, I was just telling students this the other day that I was also naively really excited about studying rough lemurs because very few people had. And so I was like, oh, yeah, there are all these open opportunities. People have never studied them before. So this is my chance to, you know, learn all this new stuff. Except that, you know, in hindsight, you'd see all these behaviors and you'd wonder why on earth these behaviors are occurring. And is this normal? And have other people seen this? But nobody studied them, right? So now I don't know if other people have seen this because people just don't study them. It was sort of a blessing and a curse picking rough lemurs because it was really hard initially to do. But I have to say that the more I learn about them, the more questions I have. And so it's been really fun to actually watch my own research evolve because new questions keep coming up. Earliest studies of rough lemurs studied them in the austral winter, which is essentially in America, our summer vacation, right? And so that's when grad students have the chance to actually get out into the field and study these animals. And so what those studies found is that rough lemurs lived in small, seemingly pair-bonded groups of just a male and a female. They had relatively small home ranges, meaning that they didn't travel very far. And that was kind of the story, right? But then when you had people like Natalie Vasey and Hillary Simons-Moreland going out into the field and doing longer term stuff, they found something completely different. Lots of primates live in relatively cohesive social groups, right? So that their activity and their movement is typically coordinated through space and time, so that when you find one animal in the forest, you can pretty reliably know that you're going to encounter other animals from that same social group. With ref lemurs, they have something called fission fusion, where they live in a community of a given number of individuals, let's say 20 individuals in a community. So we know predictably that within 80 hectares of space, we can find those animals. However, you cannot always predictably find the same animals together at the same time. And so they're a lot more flexible in terms of the amount of time they spend together and where they spend that time together. And their activity is not necessarily always coordinated. So you can have two or three animals foraging together in a tree. When one animal's done, that animal can take off and go to someplace else in the territory, while the other two animals will stay behind and continue feeding. And so you can have, let's say, a community of 20 animals, but throughout the course of the day, that one animal within that community will maybe associate with one other animal up to as many as 10 other animals. And that's it, over through space and time. And so the thinking is that this is probably driven by the fact that they're highly frugivorous, and fruit is a really patchily distributed resource. It's really high quality. And so living in larger, more stable groups might mean more competition for the animals living in those groups. And this is especially true in Madagascar because the climate is so variable. It's super unpredictable. And so you don't necessarily know when there's going to be fruit available and how long it's going to be available for. And so having that fission fusion system allows animals flexibility in terms of accessing resources without being in direct competition with one another.
That actually makes so much sense with their reproductive strategy. So ruff lemurs are really unusual for diurnal primates, or primates that are active during the day, because instead of having a single infant that clings to mom the moment they're born, ruff lemurs can have up to 6 infants at a time, but usually they have 2 to 3. And you'd think that with so many buns cooking in the ruff lemur mom's oven at once, she'd have a longer gestation period. And it's actually the opposite. It's just over 100 days. So that means ruff lemur babies come out pretty helpless and uncoordinated at first, and they're not clinging to mom, much less a tree branch. So this fission fusion system provides the safety net that those babies need to survive, right?
And so moms have to put them in nests like birds. But then these animals are also super klutzy. Babies fall out of the nests constantly. And so there has to be somebody there to watch them. And so in order for mom to leave to go feed and forage, someone has to be there to take care of the babies. And so what you end up seeing is that females who never associate throughout the year, all of a sudden when they have kids, start hanging out with each other and they start sharing in infant care responsibilities. So I think that flexibility, again, is just another strategy that helps them successfully survive and reproduce.
What strategies do ruff lemurs use to raise these relatively tiny babies?
So essentially, moms will make this really nicely constructed platform nest. So they stack a ton of branches on top of each other to give this really solid structure on usually really thick, girthed trees. So they're stable. These trees are really stable. The babies are born into there, and then the babies usually stay in that nest for about the first 4 weeks of life, and they do not move from that nest at all. And so really, when you're observing a mother in the nest, you're literally just staring at the crown of a tree because you can't see what's going on inside the nest. At that point, by about 4 weeks, you can start seeing the babies bouncing around in the nest. So they're starting to explore. They're starting to become a little bit more mobile. They're not coordinated at all, and they still can't really travel on their own. And so what's interesting too is that still at a month old, babies aren't clinging. And so the mom has to carry infants in her mouth. So they're essentially go into her mouth and wrap their bodies around her head. And she has to move them one by one from one tree to another. And so at that point, she starts moving the babies out of that, what I call a natal nest, into nearby adjacent nests. And we think that movement of infants away from the nest is an anti-predator strategy because feces and urine is starting to accumulate. You want to avoid attracting predators. And so you start moving your infants to other areas. And we also think that has to do with mom foraging. So she starts bringing her babies to areas where she's starting to feed.
By about 6 weeks, the infants will venture out onto the limbs of the trees, and a different kind of shared parenting begins, with 2 or 3 litters of ruffed lemurs coming together.
So now the babies are being put together in kindergartens. Everybody's helping to take care of the kids. And then I would say by about 3 months of age, they're more or less traveling on their own.
Baby season at the Lemur Center is wonderful, but also very stressful because they can just be so dang clumsy. We don't let baby lemurs actually go out into our forested habitats until they hit a certain age and weight to kind of minimize the risk of injuries. But in the wild, if those rough lemur babies are bouncing around in a nest for a couple of months and testing out their muscles and coordination, there's going to be some falls, right?
Yeah. Unfortunately, seems like that's one of the leading causes of infant mortality is it's the falls from the trees. We've never actually found an infant cadaver on the ground, but that doesn't necessarily mean a whole lot. But there have been several instances where we've been following the animals, and the way we do it when they have babies is we'll essentially stake out a tree. So you'll sit at the base of the tree where there's a nest and watch who's coming and going to the nest. And there have been several cases where babies have fallen literally 5 feet in front of us on the ground. And you're like, oh God, what do we do? So you kind of try and quietly back away from where the baby is so mom can come and retrieve it. And more often than not, the mother will actually come down from the tree and get the baby because, again, these babies are still uncoordinated, so they can't climb the tree to get back up to the nest. And we've never seen a baby die on impact. I guess that's one good thing about being in a rainforest habitat is that there's lots of padding, right? There's lots of leaf litter on the ground. And so they kind of bounce when they hit the ground.
And as with other animals in the wild, survival still isn't guaranteed. Between droughts and cyclones, predators and climate change, not every infant makes it. But by having multiple offspring at a time, Andrea found that rough lemurs can maximize the chances that their species continues, even if there's a year where a female doesn't give birth. Andrea's genetic work will help determine the relationship between all the little lemurs that are in a single kindergarten. If there's a male hanging around to help, is that the father to all the infants, or is that male who's helping, does he have a different relationship to the infants or the other parents who are part of this kindergarten? While she waits for those results, she's also working on other questions.
My student, Nina Beebe, just finished her field work for her dissertation, and she worked at two sites in Ranomafon, one that was highly disturbed, and Mongevu, where I work, which is not disturbed. And what's cool is that she did a comparison. So she collected data simultaneously at both of the sites. And it does seem like the social flexibility really has to do with environmental quality. So I think it's a starting point. But what's also exciting is that Nina's stuff now, because she's so interested in feeding ecology, nutritional ecology, and energy, she's actually finding that, yes, they're socially and behaviorally very different at these two sites, but it also seems like they're relying on a lot less diversity of fruit just because the large fruiting trees were selectively logged from the area where she was working. But interestingly enough, nutritionally, they're able to compensate so that they're still coming to the same nutritional niche, essentially, just by consuming very different things. They're doing lots of crop raiding, which surprised me because we always assumed Varicia don't come to the ground. They don't travel terrestrially, but they would move well outside of the park to access food trees that were still standing. But then they were also eating bananas. They were eating guava. So they're actually doing a heck of a lot better than we thought they were going to be doing, even in a highly disturbed site, which makes it, for me, it's like, oh, well, that's really promising then that maybe they aren't as environmentally constrained as we thought. And then, I mean, the sort of downside to that is, okay, so if it's not their ecology, then what's driving their population decline? And unfortunately, it seems like it might be hunting.
Hey guys, just jumping in here to say that I know the concept of hunting lemurs sounds totally foreign to a lot of our listeners, but 80% of the people living in Madagascar provide food for themselves and their families through subsistence farming, and that sometimes means subsidizing with hunting. That's not the case for all Malagasy people or all species of lemur. Andrea is speaking specifically to her study area of ruffed lemurs right now. That's why conservation partnerships rooted in community are the key to our Sava Conservation Program. The needs and motivations of people and animals, the effects of bigger forces like climate change, there are so many complex interactions that we have to consider as we work together.
I feel like so many of our conversations as we get near the end end up getting a little depressing. We're talking about extinction risk, human impact, climate change, and all of that is present. It's real that this is affecting the species that we're talking about. But One of the things that's clear from this conversation is that rough lemurs have this amazing adaptability kind of built into them. And that adaptability actually gives me some very real hope.
And that's part of why your genetic research is so important, right? To learn all we can about the ruffed lemurs living in Madagascar while we still can. So after you collect these samples and coordinate with the Malagasy and U.S. governments to get them back to your lab at Hunter College, what happens next?
I'm really interested in the paternity stuff and just general patterns of relatedness within a social group, trying to understand how that influences behavior. And then using that information to then relate patterns of genetic diversity within populations to different features in the landscape using remote sensing. So looking at things like forest cover or roads or rivers or heights of canopies or agricultural lands, things like that. And you can actually use these really cool modeling procedures that's based on circuit theory. And so you're essentially looking, treating gene flow as an electrical current. And you're seeing how genes flow across the landscape and how genes differentially flow across different features in the landscape so that you can essentially, in the end, figure out what about the environment makes it easy for animals to move from one place to the other. And then sort of on the flip side, okay, if you're finding areas where there's really low movement, what do we need to put into place to then improve or encourage movement? And that's really important just in terms of long-term survival of the species, because you want to maintain genetic diversity within populations, because genetic diversity is what allows animals to adapt to changes in their environment. So we're doing a lot of that now, both with the blood samples, but you can also do that with fecal samples. It's the same idea. You just basically extract the DNA from whatever the medium is that you've collected it in, and then you can do a bunch of lab stuff to generate your data.
And with that, our last question that we always ask our guests is, what is your favorite lemur?
Well, I feel like it would be cheating to say rough lemurs. So rough lemurs are my number one. They always will be. They always have been. But I would say beyond rough lemurs, my bucket list taxon that I have still never seen in the wild, having gone to Madagascar for, 25 years now or something, is the aye-aye. I love them. They are weird. They are surprisingly terrifying. Like, I get why there's FADI against them, because having seen them at the Duke Lemur Center in person, they're just creepy, but they're so cool. I love them.
It's part of the reason we named it aye-aye Pod, so we appreciate that answer.
Thank you so much for all of your time. I learned a lot through this conversation, which I knew I would.
Yeah. Thank you, Andrea.
All right. Thanks. It was nice meeting you.
Thank you for tuning in for this episode of iiPod.
This podcast is brought to you ad-free by the Duke Lemur Center.
If you'd like to learn more about the Duke Lemur Center's work in research, education, and conservation, or even schedule a visit to see the lemurs
or the fossils
in Durham, North Carolina, go to lemur.duke.edu.
All that we do here at the Lemur Center is only possible with donor support. If you'd like to support us, you can visit lemur.duke.edu/donate. And with that, thanks for Matt
and Megan
and all the primates at the Duke Lemur Center.